For this evening's talk, I'm going to talk on Buddhist values. Again, even just coming in here and sitting down, I didn't have a clue what I was going to speak about, but I recall that just yesterday I went to a seminar for the heads of religions organized by the Council of Churches, and we started talking about the place of religion in school. And that quickly turned to the place of values in education. And from that, onto the different value systems we have. And it's fascinating to understand what Buddhist values are, especially in the context of kids. But in such forums, I'm not afraid of stirring people up, because I think that that's part of the job of giving a talk, to stir people up, to make them think. And see things in a different way. Because too often when we have forums and discussions, we're just too nice to each other, which has its place as well. There's a place for friendship. But I always remember that when I was young, with your friends, in those days when you used to go down to the pub, of course I gave that many, many years ago, but we used to have these great arguments, and really quite fierce arguments, you know, sometimes shouting at each other. But you could do that with your friend, because you realise that you weren't getting angry, you were just being quite firm, and you realise the friendship was strong. And the friendship was much stronger than any argument. And you'd always leave friends. You felt that understanding of each other, that friendship you had towards each other, was strong enough to actually to allow disagreements. And I think now that these days we have a lot of friendships between the different religions and the different religious leaders. I think the Anglican bishop said to me at that meeting, he said, "Oh, you're just like an honorary Anglican now. You're giving a sermon at the church so often, at the cathedral." He called me an honorary Anglican. I was quite touched by that. It was very nice of him to say things like that. And I said, "Because you've got a bald head, you know, you're an honorary Buddhist." So we're great friends. But one of the things which I said there, which was, stop the idea of religious values, and we got to values itself, was when we started talking about sort of the place of religious schools. And you may notice there's, you know, there's Hindu, they're not a Hindu school, but there are Jewish schools, there's Muslim schools, there's Catholic, there's Anglican schools, United Church school, Methodist schools, but there's not a Buddhist school. One of the reasons is, you know, just personally, I've got a bit of an ethical problem with religious schools. And one of those reasons is that, you know, we have to be at least 18 before we feel that we're competent to choose a political party and vote. And we have to be at least 16 before we're mature enough, you know, to choose a sexual partner. But it seems that any old age will do to choose a religion. And religions are very important things, and I think you should be very mature and competent before, you know, you choose a religion for yourself. Now, certainly I remember in my case, I was at least 16 and before I chose my religion. And I did that in what I thought was a reasonable way, just by getting books on all the different religions. And I thought, if you're going to choose a religion, let's find out what they are, first of all. And I found out all the, you know, the books from the different religions, and I chose Buddhism because it meant the most to me. But, you know, sometimes when we talk about imposing religious values in schools, I have a lot of problem with that, because sometimes are our children really ready? Are they mature and competent enough to discriminate between, you know, what's a good religion, what's a bad religion? Or what part of religion, what religion really is? I know that one of our monks in England was once asked that question by a concerned parent. They were Buddhist parents, they just had a child. And they asked him this very profound question: "We're Buddhists, I just had a child, how should I bring my child up? Should I bring my child up as a Buddhist? Or should I just take them to all the different churches and let them choose for themselves? I should just forget about it, don't even talk about religion at home until they grow up. Or what should I do?" And this monk gave some very, very good advice, and I've never been able to better that advice. He said, "Bring your child up, number one, to be honest, and number two, to be questioning." He said, if you teach your child or encourage your child in those two good qualities of honesty and questioning, then you're equipping your child to find out their own truth in life. Honesty would mean that you would never actually stop at a religion or a philosophy or a belief. It didn't make sense. Because honesty is not just honesty to other people, it's honesty to yourself, honesty to life. If it doesn't fit, then it can't be true. So that's one of the first things, is actually to really value honesty so strongly. Number two, to question. Because sometimes we never reach truth because we give up questioning. Sometimes it's just too hard after a while. And we don't ask the right questions, or we're just fed up with questions. This will do. Just we want to be told the answer. And this monk was saying, no, just allow your child, encourage your child to be questioning and to be honest. And then you're giving them the two very powerful tools that when they grow up, when they choose their own religion, they will question each religion. They will be honest and they will not stop until they get a good answer. And I thought that was brilliant advice on just on how to encourage children in their life without brainwashing and without forcing them to follow the beliefs of their parents. Actually to follow that what's underlying those beliefs. And that brought you actually onto what underlies beliefs, the values which we have in our world. I know I got upset the Jewish rabbi at this talk because I said that values will always be changing with our times. And he got very upset about that, thought that values should be the same no matter what. And you know, values do change over our time. Sometimes we make mistakes in our values, and we learn by those mistakes, and we grow from those mistakes, because I'm sure you know that anyone who's read history, the values which different religions espoused 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, caused all sorts of mayhem in society. Whether it was oppressing women, or any culture which was different than ours, we just would not accept into our midst. And we had exploitations, and some of the things we did to each other, in history, have just been abominable. And our value systems do change, and I think it's good that they change as we become a wiser world culture. But I think what the rabbi was pointing to, there's something which underlies that, which is almost constant. And for many of the God-centered religions in that meeting, their value system came from a god. So where does Buddhist value systems come from? When we don't acknowledge the almightiness of a god. And those value systems of Buddhism, and this is where Buddhist values come from, it comes from the mindful, peaceful heart of each human being. And I say that because this very profound truth lies there, the source of values. I say that because sometimes that people ask me these questions, of is it right to do this, is it right to do that? I've got a child in my womb, I can't look after it, should I have an abortion? Sometimes they ask monks that because they don't know who else to ask. Sometimes they ask, I'm having trouble with my husband, should I get a divorce? And then those questions come as well. Or my cat is very sick. Should I take it to the vet and have it put down? And very often as a monk, I answer those questions like this. I say, well, what do you feel in your heart? Be quiet, be still, be peaceful. And how do you feel the situation is? In the case of like animals, I said, ask the animal what it wants to do. And by that, I mean you don't go sort of ask your cat and expect the cat to speak back to you in words. I say, ask the cat, and what that's doing with those words, you're focusing on that animal, you're asking the question, you're posing it, and then you feel with your guts, with your heart, what that animal wants to do. And very often, as an owner, not an owner so much as like a friend of that being, as a partner in that relationship between the human being and the pet cat or the pet dog, you feel inside, that cat's had enough, it wants to go to the vet. Or sometimes you feel, no, it's not. It really wants to stay, it wants to die at home, it wants to have a few more days. And yet you can feel that when you're silent, you're peaceful, you give up fear, and you really listen to what's going on. It's an example of what I mean about where Buddhist values come from. They come from a compassionate, peaceful heart. They don't come from books. They don't come from outside of you. They certainly don't come from a monk. And if you look for the values from a monk, sometimes a monk may say something, but as my teacher Ajahn Chah said, that sometimes what the monks say are contradictory. Because he said if he sometimes sees somebody leaning to the left, he'll tell them to go to the right. If they're leaning to the right, he says go to the left. And they get confused. Now you tell me to go to the right, now you tell me to go to the left. Because the answers address that one particular situation. You cannot generalize. When the problems with values and ethics, if we try and generalize, we get a value for all people for all time. And you just cannot do that. Every situation, every person is so unique. But instead of just leaving a person with confusion, the Buddhist values really shine. They say, listen to your heart. Feel what's going on. Feel what's right, feel what's wrong. It's one of the stories I say, I was on Talkback Radio in Singapore some time ago. And again, that people ask, this was on one of those programs of free psychological advice. We can just ring in, and it's much cheaper than going to a shrink. And you get sort of these people on the other end of the line on the radio who just answer these questions just off the top of your head. And this question which was asked was came from a man in Singapore. I think it was a taxi driver, if I remember correctly. And he said, I'm married, I'm having an affair with another woman, is that right? Now, what would you do on radio, live on air, if someone asked that question to you? Now, I gave him the direct Buddhist answer. And the direct Buddhist answer was, if it was right, you wouldn't be ringing me up to ask. Now, they wasn't actually saying, yes, it's right, or no, it's wrong. He was actually going back to how that guy was feeling inside. And you recognize how that fellow was feeling inside. Because his question was betraying the fact he thought it was wrong. His question, the fact he rang up the radio, was that it was troubling him. And that's why, if he was no trouble at all, if he was at ease with that situation, he wouldn't ask anybody. This is what we do when we have those problems. We ask someone else, and actually to say, yeah, it's all right, so you know, we know it's wrong, but we want someone else to convince him it's right, because we want to do it. But here I was going to his side and said, you know, if it was a problem, you wouldn't ring me up. It was troubling him. And I was telling him to listen inside to yourself that it's troubling you. Therefore, it must be wrong. You don't need to go and ask a monk. You don't need to go and ask a therapist or some expert in society. You will know yourself if you'd only listen inside. Which is why that this is the source of Buddhist values. It's actually the source of all values. It's not some god or expert outside. If anything, it's like the god or the expert inside. And the reason that we do meditation is so we can access that. We can actually get to know how we feel. We can get to know what's right and what's wrong. And that answers just so many problems, so many ethical dilemmas in life. One of the greatest ethical dilemmas I was presented with once, and I answered it in the same way, was from a young doctor who came here. And just after one Friday night talk, he came up to me and he said something had happened the last week which had really thrown him and he didn't know what he should do next. He was on duty, an intern at one of the hospitals. In those days they had these little pagers on their belts. The pager went off, one of his patients had a cardiac arrest. And he ran to that patient's bedside. He did the resuscitation. The patient survived, but the oxygen supply was stopped long enough that the patient had permanent brain damage. He would not die, but he would not really live a proper life again. And this doctor's actions had put this patient in the prison of his body for probably many, many years. He wasn't that sick that he would die, but the brain damage meant he would not live anything like a quality life again. And this poor doctor felt so guilty. He said he felt, you know, almost on the subconscious level, anger coming out from this man that he didn't let him die. And because of the doctor's actions, he was caught in between life and death in this terrible situation. And so he asked me, what should I do next when my pager goes off? Should I let the person die? Or should I resuscitate? What the heck should I do? Because I don't want to do the same mistake again. I mean, the question, the answer was, again, next time that happens, rush to that bedside. Stop. Just for a second and listen with everything you've got. Make your mind still. Make your mind peaceful. And in those few moments, you'll be able to feel deep inside what is the correct thing to do. The patient will tell you in the same way that when you're still, your cat and dog will let you know what it needs to do. The same way that when you're still, that you will know what is right and what is wrong. Those source of values comes from mindful stillness. In that mindful stillness, you feel the heart. You feel what's important for that heart, how it really works when you really leave it alone and it's free, you know, from all this controlling. That heart, its whole purpose, you know, your mind, is there to try and create compassionate action for the world. The whole value system of Buddhism, its secondary layer, the first layer is just the stillness of the heart. The secondary layer is just compassion. And that compassion is well explained by the Buddha's advice to Rahula. The basic of Buddhist compassion and ethics is never doing anything which harms another being or harms yourself. And whatever you do or say, make sure it's actually creating happiness for other beings or for yourself. Which is why that many of you know that we have 5 precepts in Buddhism. But many people can't count to 5. Some years ago, in Thailand, they were taking the 5 precepts from a monk. And as you may see, the Buddhist Anjali, where they put their hands up like this, sometimes that some of the monks noticed that one of the fingers was down. And there's only 4 fingers pointing up. And other people had 2 fingers down and just 3 fingers pointed up. And it became a little bit of a fashion to see this until somebody figured out what was going on. Was that when somebody was taking the 5 precepts in public, they didn't want to not take them because that would show that they were being a scallywag, being a naughty little Thai person. So when they were only wanted to take 4 precepts, they just put 4 fingers up. It's like crossing your fingers behind the back, but a bit more refined. When they put 2 fingers down, they're only keeping 3 precepts. And once we found out, we actually did see some people with all their fingers down. Even though they were still reciting all the words like a parrot, they decided they weren't going to keep anything. We have those 5 precepts, but all those 5 precepts, they say, why do we have those 5 precepts? And you have to know why we do these things. What's the heart of virtue? Otherwise, you can never impose virtue on your children. It's very good to say, oh, we should teach religion in school, we should teach values in school. But any kid will ask, why? Why should I do that? What's wrong? Why shouldn't I take drugs? Why shouldn't I have a girlfriend when I'm 13 or 14? Why shouldn't I have a sleepover? Why? Why can't I just stay up all night watching doing video games? Why? There has to be sort of an explanation. Why? And when you have that explanation sort of inside of yourself, if it hurts another person or hurts yourself, it becomes obvious why we shouldn't do such things. If it helps yourself, helps another person, it becomes obvious why we should do those things. So that's why in Buddhism, all these ethics, they come from like helping or hurting. Otherwise, we can't trust those things. We might impose them or try to impose them on our kids or on ourselves, but unless we understand why, we just won't follow those things. Except maybe out of fear. I'm going away in a few days. Tomorrow morning to Sydney for 4 days. If I impose the rules of a monastery out of fear, as soon as I'm gone, there'll be a party down my monastery. Ajahn Brahm's gone, now we can have a good time. But of course, that's not the way to impose anything. I just heard today that one of our members, I think their daughter, they were invited to a party, to a weekend, you know, it's a long weekend, the Anzac weekend, down south somewhere. And at the last minute, she was just so tired, you know, just working so hard. She said, no, I just can't stand going away. I'm just going to stay at home. And straight away, her daughter, I think 18, 19-year-old daughter or something, got very disappointed. Because she'd arranged a party for when her parents were away. She hadn't told her parents, but she'd arranged a party. Parents are gone. You know, you can come round, we can have a good time. And that really spoilt her and that weekend. But that's what happens at sometimes when we impose any value system or ideas of good and bad without giving a reason, and as soon as, you know, ourselves, the dictator, is gone, then things just go all over the place. It's like the speed cameras. When we don't understand why we've got speed cameras, we look in the newspapers know where they are, so we can actually find out exactly where they are. So we know there's not a speed camera in Byford today, so we can actually go fast. Now, of course, that's missing the point there, that why? And that's the reason why people don't keep rules, they don't keep laws. Why? Well, again, when I became a Buddhist, what really helped me was meditating. The idea of introspection is asking the questions of yourself rather than asking the questions of some expert. But we get this idea, we always have to find an expert to solve our problems for ourselves. As a teacher, I'm not a very good teacher. Because for the last 20 years I've been here, I've been trying to get rid of you. And many of you keep coming back. Says I'm not a good teacher. The idea of a teacher in a school or university is to get people to graduate. To impart the information, to impart the skills, they don't need to come here anymore. I must be a terrible teacher. But this is what we do, we want to impart that information, that skill, the way to look inside oneself, so we can know for oneself what those values are and how to find those values. We equip our children to find out rather than telling them what the answers are. And this is what we do for you as well, to equip you to find out. And when you actually find out from the heart, it doesn't make sense to hurt anybody or hurt yourself. What on earth would you do that for? So when I was told those sorts of things, even when I was just a young man, straight away that much of that which was unethical just fell away. Whenever I was travelling on the public transport, if I didn't have to pay the bus conductor, in other words, he didn't ask me, and I thought, why should I pay? Of extra money. But then after I started meditating, I thought, my goodness, that someone has to pay for these buses. If I don't pay my fare, it means that someone else will have to. It didn't make sense to me anymore. Not all monks started off as saints to do terrible things. Now, one of the monks, he's now quite well known. I won't tell you who he is, but he told me that when he was in England, when he would go to the football match all over England, instead of paying the money for the train fare, you get on the train with a station ticket, and then you go along the train where somebody was in the toilet in the train, you knock on the door, put on this accent, "Furs, please," as if he was a ticket collector. And usually what would happen is actually the person inside, they couldn't come out, they'd usually just, it was standard practice, you slide the ticket under the door. The ticket collector would sort of punch it and then slide it back again. That was standard practice. But this scallywag would say, "Tickets, please," and this poor man inside would slide the ticket under and he'd run off with it. And he became a famous monk. So we did all start off with the saints. But after a while, now, please don't do that. Don't go telling the people what you learned at the Buddhist centre. That's wrong. That's just an example of being a scallywag. But people think, oh, I'm smart, and that's a nice thing to do. But after a while, you just can't do that. After a while, you look in your heart and you feel terrible about that. you feel you've hurt someone. And you've hurt yourself as well. And when you start feeling your actions, what it does to you, then it's quite clear that it's unethical. So the value system starts to come back to yourself. How you feel when you do these things. Does it hurt another person? Does it hurt yourself? Does it help you? Whenever you are generous and kind, it's a wonderful thing to look inside yourself and what it feels like when you've forgiven someone who's hurt you. You feel so wonderful inside. It's like a huge burden is gone and you feel a surge of energy. It's nature. Someone has hurt you, say, look, you know, you've done a terrible thing, but never mind, I forgive you. And the worst act they've done, the more you forgive them, the better you feel. If someone has done something wrong, they've invited someone without letting me know, and I forgive them, I feel so good afterwards. Or if they've you know, done something very, very silly in my monastery, and that sometimes people do things which are silly. Sometimes I met this one young monk, you know, because he was having a hard time, he used to go into the kitchen late at night and eat all the chocolate. I always wondered where all the chocolate was going. And you think, no, he's just having a hard time, that's all. And so, you know, I found out, he was just so afraid that we're going to kick him out. And when I say, nah, then never mind. Just, you know, next time, just make sure you ask me and I'll give you your own bars of chocolate. How much do you need? With enough money in the kitty, we'll just get a special supply just for you. And when you're kind like that, straight away they stop eating so much chocolate. It's great psychology. But what you're doing over there, you're just like giving them a bit of forgiveness. And I felt great when I forgave someone like that, instead of having to criticize them. Because when you're coming into your heart, you feel why. At the retreat, I made a strong point that why we criticize each other and why we're unkind to one another. Because this actually experience came in our monastery in Northeast Thailand, when once a week we'd stay up all night meditating. It was a standard practice. Like the Buddhist Sabbath day, we wouldn't sleep. Meditate all night. What would happen very often, I noticed that arguments would start the day after staying up all night. Happened to me as well. Sometimes I'd be sitting up there doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I'd see some of these monks sneak off. I know where they were going. Or they sneak off to take a nap, or they sneak off to have a surreptitious cup of coffee somewhere, their personal stash, which they're not supposed to have as a monk. And I knew what they were up to. And so I was going to tell them off. They deserved to be told. And they did other silly things. But one day, instead of actually telling them off, I decided I'm going to have a rest first of all. And then I'll tell them off. But I'm not going to let them get away with it. I'm not going to forget. And before I went to sleep, I wrote down their names and all the things they'd done on a piece of paper. Because you know, sometimes you go to sleep, you forget these things. So I wrote down their names, the things they'd done, and then I went to sleep. And when I woke up, right, now I've got to go and tell them off. And the thing which happened, once I had a good rest and I was in a good mood, I saw all these little things which they'd done. I thought, that's really petty. Why am I going to tell someone off for doing these small, you know, silly things? And I screwed up the piece of paper and threw it away. But when I was tired, you're forgiven for not turning off your mobile phone. I feel so good about that. But please, my forgiveness has a limit, so please. When you do something like that, you feel so good about yourself. But when you're tired, that's where all the criticism comes from. And so it's not a time when you can really know your heart when you're tired. That's not the time to act. In tiredness, all ethics go out the window. You don't know what you're up to. Tiredness is like a form of drunkenness. You lose your mindfulness, your alertness. It's the same as when you get angry. Just like tiredness, you lose all your awareness. You can't feel your heart. And that's why when a person gets angry, again, all value systems go out the window. When we're angry, we can think that that person needs even to be killed. That's what happens when we get angry. We can blow each other up. And sometimes people think that that's ethical to do so. All ethics disappear when you've lost your mindfulness. So it's wired that when we get angry, as a Buddhist, if you do get angry, just don't do anything. Don't open your mouth. Don't act. Just find a nice quiet place, sit down and cool off. Or, as my teacher Ajahn Chah said, if you really have a trouble with anger, then find a quiet place, sit down and get out an alarm clock. Put it in front of you and see how long you can be angry for. See if you can beat your record. That's brilliant advice, because what it was doing, when you're getting angry, you're always looking at the trigger of your anger. My husband, he did this, he shouldn't have done that, why did he do this? You're focusing on the trigger. When you're looking at the clock, your mind is taken off the trigger. When it's taken off the trigger, it's like cutting off the fuel supply. If it's your husband, the more you think of your husband, the more angry you get. If you think about the clock, or even better, think about what it's doing to you. Feel in your guts how you feel when you get angry. And soon, you just give up that anger. It can't last when you stop its fuel, which is that person out there. And when you actually calm down, sometimes we, why did I get angry at him? I love that fella. Why did I say those things to her? You know, she's my soulmate in life. Why did I tell those terrible things to that my friend? They're my mate. What have I done? Afterwards, when you get angry, you feel so much remorse because you did do something unethical. So from that source of peace inside, mindfulness, coolness, then you usually make ethical and wise decisions. Now, what are those values which come out from a peaceful, mindful heart? I've already mentioned, you know, like compassion, which is a very, very general term. How we actually manifest that compassion, that's up to wisdom to tell you. But it also has such things as like respect and gratitude. Gratitude is a marvelous Buddhist value. And the reason it's marvelous is because gratitude is that praising somebody else. It's actually valuing the goodness of another person. And once you can have the value of the goodness of another person, you start valuing your own goodness as well. Psychologically, it's a powerful tool, gratitude. Which is why when someone does something wonderful for you, you'd always thank them, praise them, say well done. In psychology, it's called positive forgiveness. Forgiving their faults, but positively reinforcing their good qualities. It's amazing just how you can get your kids to change with such praise. Flattery gets you everywhere. One of my stories, years ago, when we started building our monastery, one of the first buildings we constructed was our ablution block. So at least we could go to the toilet in comfort. So the ablution block, and as you know, that we couldn't afford any builders. Not only laying bricks, I had to do the plumbing. I'd never done plumbing in my life before. And there I was with the task of getting the plumbing for a 6-toilet, 6-shower laundry ablution block in our monastery. The way I did that plumbing was as follows. I had the plans, and I went to Galvin's in Osborne Park. I don't know if it's still there. I went to the counter, put the plan on the desk, and said, help. That's what I did. And it was a big enough job that the fellow behind the counter, who was called Fred, spent only half an hour with me, showing exactly what the parts were, how to put them together, you know, the right type of form, so you know all the stuff went in the right direction, which is very important. And it's only like, you know, plastic and glue. You know, it's very simple once you get the hang of it. And so there I was, and I got the job of, you know, doing all the pipes. Now, when they were finished, they had to get checked by the local health inspector, the Serpentine Jawad El-Shah. He came, and it worked. And I was just so happy that, you know, my first, you know, plumbing job, it passed, you know, the council tests. And the next day, the bill came. I got a check from the treasurer. I sent it in an envelope to Galvin's, but because I was so happy, but maybe it's just because of my Buddhist values, I put a letter in there thanking Fred. Because, you know, without him, we'd have to pay a lot of money getting a plumber, if we could get one, because they're sometimes very hard to find. So I send a letter there, you know, thanks so much for Fred for teaching me how to put these things, you know, together. You know, without you, we don't know where we'd have been. And it passed. No, thanks a lot. Now, when I mailed that to Galvin's, I didn't realize, because, you know, I was a monk, I don't know these things. This is a company. It's a big company with many branches. And so the checks don't go to, you know, the fellow behind the counter. They go to the accounts department. And so a clerk in the accounts department opened this envelope, saw there's a check in there, and oh no, another letter of complaint. Because apparently the only time people send letters to the accounts department is to complain about something. So when he read the letter, it wasn't a complaint, it was a word of praise. And apparently I found out it was so rare in that company to get such a letter that he took it straight to the manager of the accounts department, who read it and was also so surprised, who took it to the managing director of the whole company. And the managing director read it on his big mahogany desk and straight away picked up the phone and called Osborne Park branch, "I want to speak to Fred." And Fred answered the phone, and the managing director said, "Fred, I've just got this letter from one of your customers." And he read it out and said, "Fred, this is exactly what we want in our company. Customer relations." "Yeah, yes, sir." "This is, you've done a marvellous job." "Oh, yes, sir." "By the way, what salary are you on?" "Oh, well, it could be better, sir. I think we can do something about that." "Oh, yes, sir." Or something like that. And it did so happen, as, you know, these things go, that happened in the morning, and that afternoon there was one extra piece which was the wrong size. So I went into the plumbing shop in the afternoon. In front of me on the counter were these big two plumbers. You know, these plumbers with their shorts and their thongs, with shoulders the size of septic tanks? Big guys, and there I was coming in my bald head and robes. But when Fred saw me, he said, "Brahm, come over here." And these two plumbers had to wait. "What could I do for you?" There's a big sign I remember seeing on there that customers are not allowed, you know, in the behind the desk. "Brahm, come over here. What do you want?" And so he took me behind where customers aren't supposed to go, so I could actually choose exactly the part I wanted. And while these other plumbers had to wait, they gave me some terrible looks. But the part I wanted was about twice the size. So it's actually like eight times the volume. And most of these things, you know, being plastic stuff, you know, it's not just twice the price, it's about eight times the price. So I said, "Fred, what's the difference?" And I always remember Fred's smile. He'd be had this big smile and said, "Brahm, for you, there's no difference." And he let me take away this very expensive part with no difference. And it's just for one little letter of praise. One little act of gratitude meant so much to Fred. And it meant so much to me, as it means so much to you. And that's like a Buddhist prayer. You can feel from the heart what that does. That touched Fred as it touched me. That's good, to praise someone. We don't get enough praise. Because we don't get enough praise, we don't feel appreciated. When we don't feel appreciated, can't live with anybody. And sometimes we feel so unappreciated we even kill ourselves. What's the point? A little bit of praise is just so wonderful. You praise your kids as much as you possibly can. Praise whatever good things they do. And if you praise them, you know, I can't resist telling this story again. When I was a school teacher, in my class, as would has to happen, one of the kids came bottom of the class in maths. 30th out of a class of 30. How could you praise someone for coming bottom? I found a way. I went up to that kid and I taught him a little bit of Buddhism. In Buddhism we have this idea of a bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is someone who gives up their own happiness for the sake of others, sacrifices everything, you know, for other people's well-being. And I told this little kid, you are like a bodhisattva. You have sacrificed your happiness by taking this terrible position of 30th. So no one else will have to suffer. All those other kids don't have to go and face their parents, you know, I come bottom of the class. So, you know, you've actually made this huge heroic sacrifice by coming to the bottom of the class. In fact, of all these kids, you're the one, in Buddhism anyway, deserves the medal. I will give up my own status, my own happiness and well-being for all other beings. All the other 29, you don't have to experience what I'm experiencing. So you're just a hero. He thought I was absolutely crazy. But he laughed, and that laughter took away his depression. And he went away, it wasn't such a big deal anymore. A little bit of praise, even when they come bottom, is actually quite sometimes quite helpful. You can always find something, some way of praising somebody or other. I remember this person who was, he was never said a bad word about anyone, and that really upset his colleagues at work. And so his colleagues at work said, well, you just can't find a bad thing to say about anyone. What about Adolf Hitler? Say something good about Adolf Hitler. Now that was a challenge. But it only took him 2 seconds. He said, Adolf Hitler, yes, he was a leader in his field. You always find something to praise. But anyhow, the point is that praise is therapeutically good. It encourages people. That's why gratitude is one of those values which I like to, you know, teach in schools. Praising your teacher for going out of their way to teach you. Praising your parents for all the good things they've done. It's called respect. Praising, you know, the person sitting next to you in class for being your friend. Praising yourself for trying. Everybody in life tries. Each one of you struggles so hard, and sometimes that much of your efforts, which have often been heroic efforts, go unrewarded, unpraised, unrecognized. Wouldn't it be wonderful for someone to come up to you and say, I realize what you've done and how hard you've struggled just to get where you are today. Well done. That bit of praise, how does it make you feel when you do get praise? Get your gut feeling again, and you know that is value, that is ethical, that is good. You feel it's good, and it works to create harmony and happiness and peace in society. You praise your husband, your wife, you haven't got both, but you know, you've just got one, but whichever one you've got. Praise your partner in life, praise your parents, praise your kids, as much as you can, for things which are praiseworthy, and you'll find that they will grow. They'll have self-confidence, self-esteem, they will grow in goodness, because whatever you praise, that's what grows. The old simile which I give, having a garden, if you water the weeds, then the weeds grow. That's called criticism, finding fault. If you don't water anything, nothing grows. That's called, you know, just not getting involved. If you water the flowers, then the flowers grow. That's called praise. So we have gratitude, which is a form of praise. We say thank you. And we express that as much as we possibly can. That is a great Buddhist value, because we know it creates happiness for ourselves, happiness for others. When we get to the virtue, not harming, all those virtues, they come naturally. Sometimes, you know, as people ask, can we be given the 5 precepts? And you say, be mindful. Feel the heart. And then you've got all the precepts you'll ever need in the world. And they're not sort of precepts where we, you know, try and find a way out of them. You know, sometimes we find out, you know, what about white lies? Is that breaking the precepts? It wasn't really a lie, you know, I just told them what they wanted to hear, that's all. But is that really... How in your heart, what's actually gone on there? Someone has trusted you and you've deceived them. What does that do to the other person? What does that do to yourself? Feel your heart and you realize that is wrong. So right and wrong, you don't need to have an expert. You don't need to even be taught it. As long as you are honest to your feelings and you ask the right questions, you go inside, you'll have all the values and ethics you will ever need. And that way that sort of unscrupulous people will not be able to impose those beliefs on you. We're very easily brainwashed. We're conditioned. Sometimes, you know, people who have the flaw can very easily sort of turn people into being violent. You know, the psychology of crowds has been well documented. If you say the right words, you can really get people upset and get them to do terrible things. Maybe that even happens in like footy matches or at sport or in demonstrations. But if you feel your heart, you always realize what's right and what's wrong. So in inculcating values, not just in children but in everybody, that's why the Buddhism doesn't really tell you too much of what you should be doing. It doesn't lay down the law saying, what do you think about homosexuality? What do you think about abortion? What do you think about stem cell research? What do you think about terrorism? What do you think about multiculturalism? What do you think about... Buddhism has a great advantage of telling you how to find out for yourself. It's not just leaving you to swallowing in sort of confusion, but teaching you a means so you can really know why. And you can feel it. And that way people become ethical people. Not because they're trying to keep some rules. Not because I'm a Buddhist I should keep the five precepts. Not because I'm a Christian I should keep the Ten Commandments. Which a lot of times if people like that, they only keep them when they come to the temple. As soon as they go outside, they argue. They go to the pub. They go and get drunk. They go down to the red light district or whatever. So when it comes from the heart, it's right inside of you, and the ethics is coming from the right place. You're not just what we call the Jostic Buddhist. The Jostic Buddhist, before they go to the temple, like their Jostics, put them in the thing, ask for a lottery number, and then they go out and just all sorts of scallywag things. Just like, you know, the Christian would just go to the temple, they go to the church, and be so pious inside, and just so sort of devious outside. So those sorts of people, they haven't got the church inside of them. They haven't got the temple inside. They haven't got the wisdom inside. They're going to the wrong place for their values. And the reason we call them values is because they're important. They're valuable. We know that it feels good. It's happiness. It's, you know, it's self-esteem. It's important for us. That's why whatever we find is valuable. It's interesting, in the Sanskrit, in the Pali, we call these heavy, important things. You know that the Hindu word from the Sanskrit word, guru, you know where that comes from? It means something which is heavy. In Pali, it's garu. Garu, guru, same word. That's why we call them a teacher, because what they say is important. It has weight. It's a weighty person. And that's why that when we have this word for respect, like, you know, respecting senior monks or senior nuns or respecting your parents, a lot of children ask me, what does that actually mean, you should respect your parents? What Buddhist value is there in that? Because sometimes they say, my parents aren't really respectable. You know, find it hard to respect them. And sometimes that's the case, you know, when parents just misbehave and they argue in front of their kids and they're not kind, they maybe even hit their wife. How can you respect that? Should I always do what my parents tell me to? Is that what respect means? Should I always do what the monk says? Is that what respect says? And this is not what respect means. When we used to ask Ajahn Chah, you know, is this right or is this wrong? He'd always say, have you any doubts about this? In other words, are you quite sure you know what you're doing? And if he'd say, yes, I'm sure I know what I'm doing, he said, go ahead and do it. This is actually how we learn, finding out for ourselves. But the reason why we call them a teacher or a parent is because they're weighty. So when kids ask me, what does respect for a parent mean? I mean, your parent, whatever they say, has huge weight. And you listen to that. What they say is much more weighty than maybe what your friend at school says. But it doesn't mean that sometimes you get many other things, many other information that outweighs what your parents say. because sometimes parents do make mistakes. But what respect means is you really listen very carefully to what your parents say. What, you know, respectable people, which means like weighty people. So respect in Buddhism means weighty, which is one of the reasons why I am quite fat, because being a senior monk, I have to be weighty. But what we mean is we give extra weight, you know, to such figures who are respectable. And this is actually how, what respect really means. Respect doesn't mean we always do what they say. Respect means we consider what they say. That's really important. That's very weighty. That really has an important contribution to what we're eventually going to decide. When we understand that sort of value, it makes so much sense. It doesn't mean we always follow blindly, because sometimes people think that respect means you always do what you're told. And of course, you know, the monks who've been in my monastery know that never works. Even though we just have the two main rules of our monastery, and those two main rules of our monastery is, number one, the abbot is always right. Number two, if the abbot is wrong, go back to rule number one. We only joke about that. That's not really correct. That's why I'm the spiritual dictator of the Buddhist Society, not director. But no. But what I say has extra weight in the monastery, because I've been there longer, many more years as a monk, but people are still free to disagree with me, and I think that's very healthy. Otherwise, we'd have a cult. The same with each one of you is very free to disagree with what you hear here. Otherwise, you'll be just a cult again. Again, going back to the very, very beginning, how we train kids. Don't bring them up as a Buddhist. Don't bring them up as a Catholic. Don't bring them up, you know, this religion and that religion. Bring them up with these qualities, the roots of values, to question and to be honest. And if you can do that yourself, never give up questioning. And also, never compromise your honesty, your commitment to truth. Even if that might be embarrassing to be honest, still, you should be honest. Be honest to life. Be honest to truth. Honest to yourself, to your partner. Always question. And there, you have the root of all values. So that's a little excursion today on Buddhist values and their roots.